You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.
My name is George Sanders, and I'm a practicing physician here in Los Angeles. Today I'm going to talk about antidepressants. Are antidepressants good for anything? Now, some of you may have handouts. If you don't, they are available online. But most of the material in the handout is going to be covered today on the screen in front of you. 10 to 15% of Americans take antidepressants. That's about one in six. Okay, that's a lot. Many are taken to treat depression, but many are also taken to treat other conditions. It's said that antidepressants are of questionable value in the treatment of depression, but are they good in the treatment of anything else? To answer that, first we're going to look at how mental illness has been treated over the years, from about 5,000 BC to the present. How do antidepressants fit into this timeline? We're then going to look at the evidence, whether they do or don't work for depression, and then are there any other disorders for which they are an effective treatment? Let's put antidepressants into perspective. They are the latest chapter in the attempt by organized medicine to understand mental illness as biological in origin and best treated with a biological treatment. To be able to understand and treat an illness medically, it's important that the cause be known. What causes mental illness? Well, the answer to that question has preoccupied those who deal with mental health issues for thousands of years. But before we dive into that, let's talk about mental illness. What is a good definition? And this is more from the medical perspective. But today, psychiatry would define it as a condition, as a mental condition that causes behavior that's a threat to oneself or others, or causes so much pain and suffering that it interferes with one's work responsibilities or relationships with family and friends. Now, throughout history, there have been three dominant theories as to the cause of mental illness: the supernatural, the biological, and psychogenic. Supernatural would be possession by evil or demonic spirits, displeasure of gods, curses, sin. Biological, well, it would be said to have a physical origin, like illness, genetics, or perhaps brain damage. And psychogenic, it originates in the mind. The treatment of mental illness is then determined by what you believe about its cause. For instance, when you believe that it's due to demonic possession, you might treat it with exorcism. But if you think that it's due to excess blood, well, then you'd treat the patient with bloodletting. Think of a rope that represents the cause of mental illness. It would have three strands representing the supernatural, the biologic, and the psychogenic. These three strands have been weaving themselves throughout the history of mental illness, and we're going to go right into that now. This is a kind of busy slide, but I'm going to take you through it step by step. It's interesting. What has been believed about the cause of mental illness? Let's start 5000 BC. That would be shortly after Noah's flood. Some men were living in caves, and we know that they believed in a supernatural cause from archaeological findings from that time. Archaeologists who studied the skulls and cave art of that period found evidence of trephining, and that's the process of boring a hole in the skull done with the use of stone instruments. And apparently it was believed that by opening up a hole in the skull, you would allow the evil spirits to escape the head of the mentally ill victim, and that cured them of their affliction. Now, interestingly, this process was not universally fatal. Some of the skulls actually showed evidence of healing, and researchers believe that those individuals survived the trephining process and lived for years afterwards. As a result, trephining endured for centuries, and it was used for treatment of a number of different conditions, such as skull fractures, migraine, epilepsy, as well as mental illness. 3,000 years later, Egyptian papyri were found that indicate belief in a biological cause. These documents describe women suffering from a mental illness that they attributed to a wandering uterus. The condition was later called hysteria by the Greeks. That's from the Greek word hystera, which is the word for uterus. They thought the uterus could become dislodged and wander throughout the body, attaching to different areas like the liver or chest cavity. And because they believed that hysteria had a biological cause, they employed a biological treatment. Strong-smelling substances were given to these women to guide the uterus back to its proper location. Pleasant odors to lure it, and unpleasant ones to chase it away. Sort of like a joystick on a game video. Now, about the same time, the Mesopotamians were promoting a supernatural cause of mental illness. Shamans, who would actually use rituals based on religion and superstition, since they believed that demonic possession was the cause of mental disturbances. A bit later on, two papyri from 600 BC that had been called the oldest medical books in the world were found that identified the brain as a source of mental functioning. Now, Greek physicians also rejected supernatural explanations and proposed biological causes. Around 400 BC, the Greek physician Hippocrates, who is considered to be the father of modern medicine, or at least medicine back then, he proposed the idea that mental illness and even physical illness resulted from an imbalance of four fluids in our bodies, and he called these the four humors: blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. And when these humors were out of balance, illness, including mental illness, was the result. For example, someone who was too temperamental suffered from too much blood, and thus bloodletting would be the necessary treatment. And by the way, this belief in the theory of humoral imbalance continued for the next 2,000 years. 600 years later, in 200 AD, the Greek physician Galen proposed a psychogenic cause. That's the first we've heard that. A psychogenic cause of mental illness, when he suggested that psychological stress might be a cause. But when he died, that sort of faded away, and belief in the theory of humoral imbalance still continued as the leading theory. And in light of that belief, doctors began to give patients laxatives, emetics to produce vomiting, leeches, and cupping therapy to correct the imbalance. Concoctions containing various plants were also given to cure depression, the first antidepressants. Other treatments saw doctors withdrawing blood from veins in the forehead to drain the imbalanced humors away from the brain. Later on, from 1000 to 1400 AD, really the Middle Ages, supernatural theories of the origin of mental disorders began to dominate European thought pretty much as they had in the time of the cavemen. Natural disasters like plagues and famines were thought to be of demonic origin, so why not mental illness? As a result, you had superstition, astrology, alchemy taking hold, and treatments for mental illness began to include prayer rites, relic touching, confessions, and atonement. Beginning in the 13th century, the mentally ill, especially women, were viewed as possessed and subjected to persecution. But with the 1700s came the Age of Enlightenment, also known as the Age of Reason. These supernatural theories were replaced by scientific theories. Dr. Benjamin Rush, who is considered the father of psychiatry in the United States, he also signed the Declaration of Independence. He was a thought leader at that time, and he believed that mental disease was caused by irritation of blood vessels in the brain. This led to his support of treatments such as bloodletting and his invention of gyrators and tranquilizer chairs, and that is a tranquilizer chair. You would basically hold the patient upright so that the blood could drain away from those problematic vessels in the brain, and he felt that would improve the symptoms. The competition between biologic and psychogenic causes of mental illness was particularly keen in the 1800s. Hysteria was a mental condition that caused physical symptoms such as blindness and paralysis. The supporters of a biological cause were led by the German physician Franz Mesmer, the father of hypnosis, from whose name we get the term mesmerize. Mesmer proposed that hysteria was caused by imbalance in the magnetic fluid found in the bodies of patients, and that this imbalance would be best treated with magnets. This is a magnetic tub, and people would sit around it and place their hands on it, and current would pass through it, magnetism would result, and people would be cured, I guess. At least that was a hope, huh? On the other hand, a physician named Sigmund Freud familiar, was able to successfully treat hysteria through hypnosis. This favored a psychogenic explanation of the disease, and this led to his development of psychoanalysis around 1900. And psychoanalysis has really continued to be the dominant psychogenic treatment for mental illness, even into today's world, particularly the first half of the 1900s. Really provided the launching pad for more than 400 different schools of psychotherapy that are still alive today. So what have we learned from this overview of 7,000 years of history ending around 1900? Well, there's no consensus as to the cause of mental illness. Belief in all three of these causes, spiritual, biological, psychogenic, has woven its way through time. And each cause has been championed by a variety of cultures and individuals. So, where do antidepressant medications come into the picture? Well, to understand the spectacular rise of antidepressant medications, we now enter the 1900s and look at what happened in the United States. As it had been throughout history, there was competition between the biologic and the psychogenic explanations for mental illness. The biologists, however, took the lead in 1897 with the discovery of a biological cause for a common mental condition. By the way, this is all very well documented in a book entitled Mind Fixers by Ann Harrington, who is a professor at Harvard. It's listed on your handout, and I'd also recommend it for further reading. Absolutely fascinating. The story begins in 1897 with a disorder first described by French asylum doctors a century earlier, known as general paralysis of the insane, or GPI for short. The illness presented with a combination of motor and mental symptoms, and this is a patient in the upper left-hand corner being ministered to by some individuals. On the motor side, patients first developed an unsteady gait and problems with speech, that then progressed to paralysis. They couldn't speak, they couldn't swallow. And there were mental problems also that began with agitated behaviors that were socially inappropriate and progressed to dementia. The condition was progressive and eventually fatal. But by the 1890s, more and more doctors were noticing something about these patients. Many had previously been treated for syphilis. Could this be a late stage result of syphilis? Well, in 1897, a German neurologist conducted an experiment in which he injected pus from the sores of patients with syphilis into the blood of 9 GPI patients to try to give them the disease. This would never pass an ethics committee today. Now, he knew that syphilis could only be contracted once. So if the men injected with pus developed early symptoms of syphilis, that meant they had never had syphilis before. But over the next several months, none of them developed any symptoms. So these patients must have had syphilis. So could syphilis actually cause GPI? Well, several years later, researchers actually discovered the bacteria that caused syphilis in the brains of GPI patients. The conclusion was that GPI was the result of syphilis. Now, this validation of a biological cause of a mental illness was huge. And if it was true of syphilis, maybe it was true of other mental conditions. But despite intense investigation, no other bacterial causes for mental illness were discovered. So doctors began to dissect the brains at autopsy of deceased mental illness patients, looking for abnormalities. Maybe they could find the source of the mental illness in abnormal brain anatomy. But much to their disappointment, no differences between these brains and those of normal patients were discovered. Things were seemingly at a dead end for the biologist. Meanwhile, Sigmund Freud, of whom we spoke earlier, began to investigate the possibility of a psychogenic cause of mental illness. I mentioned Freud and his treatment of hysteria. Freud believed that in patients with hysteria, traumatic memories were repressed and consigned to the subconscious. So he developed an interview method to bring these memories to the conscious mind. He focused on their repressed sexual fantasies and believed that these were the source of his patients' neuroses. Now, many neurologists agreed with Freud, So they gave up on anatomy and biologic explanations and instead developed a patient interview technique that allowed them to investigate the subconscious. This became known as psychoanalysis. Soon, however, the limits of this approach were exposed. During the First World War, men who returned from the trenches without physical injury displayed physical symptoms similar to those of hysteria. Clearly, they couldn't all be manifesting neuroses caused by repressed sexual fantasies. An English physician invented the term shell shock to describe this condition. We'd call it PTSD today. And he proposed a biological rather than a psychogenic cause. He thought that damage to the brain came from the shock waves of artillery explosions. But that wasn't entirely satisfactory because many of the sufferers included soldiers who had never been in the trenches or exposed to bombing. Neither the psychogenic nor the biologic explanation seemed correct. Well, as the century progressed, the schism between the psychogenic and biologic camps widened. The biological camp continued to move forward with the idea that bacteria were responsible for mental illness. With advances in the study of bacteria, they now embraced the idea that bacteria in the intestines, the mouth, or the sinuses could release toxins that impaired brain function. As a result, schizophrenia treatments included removing teeth, appendices, ovaries, testes, colons, and more. Others promoted electric shock therapy, known as electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT for short. The depressed patient would be sedated and then given an electrical shock. This gave some improvement in major cases of depression, but it was accompanied by memory loss and other significant side effects. You can only imagine. Surgery was also proposed as a treatment for mental illness. The lobotomy was developed in the 1930s by the Portuguese surgeon Egas Moniz, who received a Nobel Prize for his work. The operation involved cutting nerve connections in the front part of the brain, and it was used to calm patients with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. The treatment reached a peak in the United States with a Dr. Walter Freeman, who popularized the transorbital lobotomy. It was an operation that involved cutting nerve connections in the front part of the brain with an ice pick-like instrument that he would insert through the eye sockets. Yikes. Freeman crisscrossed the country, he called Operation Ice Pick, promoting the technique in state mental hospitals. Ultimately, however, lobotomies proved to be quite unsuccessful. One of Freeman's best-known patients was Rosemary Kennedy, the sister of President John F. Kennedy. From an early age, she had suffered with learning difficulties and had a rather headstrong nature. And because the Kennedy family feared that something would happen to the family reputation if she would become pregnant, she underwent a lobotomy by Dr. Freeman. The outcome was a disaster. All of her intellectual gains were erased, and it took months of therapy before she was able to walk and talk again. Meanwhile, Freudian psychoanalysis continued to press ahead. The years after World War II came to be known as the Age of Anxiety. People were filled with the fear of nuclear war, the cold arms race, and the possibility that communist spies were infiltrating society. Accordingly, psychoanalysis substituted anxiety for sex as the underlying cause of mental problems. There was a new focus on family dynamics, particularly the need for emotional security in early childhood. But while psychoanalysts were busy modifying their psychogenic approach to mental problems, those favoring a biological approach were equally involved in promoting their agenda. In the 1940s, a psychiatrist said this: "No one in his right mind in psychiatry is working with drugs." Well, that was true in the 1940s. They used shock or psychotherapies. Doctors did administer drugs, but they were barbiturates. Basically designed to sedate, to calm patients, help manage unruly ones. But in the 1950s, new drugs arrived. The hope was that they would not only help manage patients, but would also help patients think more clearly and act more rationally. So in 1954, the FDA approved the use of Thorazine, the first drug ever used in the treatment as opposed to the management of a specific mental disorder, and that disorder was schizophrenia. Thorazine accomplished the management of these patients in a far less destructive way than the lobotomy. You just took a pill. So the lobotomy and its ice pick were tossed into the medical trash heap. Barbiturates were still used to sedate mentally ill patients, but Thorazine was thought to be an actual treatment of the underlying cause of the disorder. The pharmaceutical industry thought that they had discovered the cure for schizophrenia. One ad claimed that Thorazine, quote, reduces or eliminates the need for restraint and seclusion, improves morale in the mental hospital, speeds release of hospitalized patients, and reduces destruction of personal and hospital property. Here you have a picture of a mental hospital with the ladies are sitting there calmly, as opposed to what had been untrue only a few months before. Well, by 1964, some 50 million prescriptions for Thorazine had been filled. The income of the drug maker increased 8 times over in a period of 15 years. Well, drug makers then moved from schizophrenia onto the treatment of anxiety. A new sedative called Miltown was introduced in 1955. And within a year, it was the best-selling drug in America. And by the close of the 1950s, get this, 1 in every 3 prescriptions written in the United States was for Miltown for anxiety sufferers. And in 1963, an alternative was introduced, and you know this one, Valium. And it became the most commonly prescribed drug in the country the next year and remained so for 19 years until 1982. Now, this brings us to the early 1960s and the development of antidepressants. Interestingly, at that time, depression was rarely discussed by psychiatrists. Anxiety was the diagnosis of choice. And if someone was feeling despondent or chronically sad, what today would be called depressed, they were said to be expressing their underlying anxiety in that way. Nevertheless, depression was becoming increasingly recognized as a common problem. And as I mentioned before, electric shock therapy was helpful in reversing severe depression, but the significant memory loss that resulted led to its fall from favor. Though there were now drugs for schizophrenia and anxiety, why not for the treatment of depression? Now, amphetamines had been developed in the 1930s for nasal congestion. They had energizing properties, hence the name uppers. Okay? Now they began to be used in depressed patients. Benzedrine was the first, followed shortly by dexedrine, which was used for depression as well as weight loss. It was also used to keep airplane pilots awake in the war. By the 1940s, 1 million tablets of benzedrine were being consumed daily. The reality, however, was that amphetamines did not seem to work well on depressed patients. Shock treatment really remained the only viable option. Then a new pill came along, quite by chance, as a side effect of an effort to create a new treatment for tuberculosis. It was named iproniazid. And during the drug's clinical trials, researchers noted that some previously bedridden patients who were near to the point of death had become energized and even euphoric in ways that doctors could not explain simply in terms of their improved health. At the Seaview Sanitarium on Staten Island in New York, patients given the drug literally danced in the halls of the ward. But the drug company that produced it was not interested in these apparent mood-lifting properties. The drug had turned out to be only modestly successful against TB, and its drug trials have been plagued by reports of a wide range of unwanted side effects. Company executives initially saw this strange euphoria that the patients experienced as just another one of them. But psychiatrists insisted, we need this drug. And so it was approved by the FDA and swiftly came onto the market as the first recognized drug treatment for depression. It was what was called an MAO inhibitor, a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, and we'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. The drug did help many chronically depressed patients, but many of them were unable to tolerate its side effects, particularly those on the liver. That's the drug that if you eat cheese while taking it, you'll have some serious, if not fatal, reactions. Okay. Faced with its association with 53 deaths, many of which were due to things like consuming cheese, and 246 cases of hepatitis, the drug manufacturer withdrew it in 1961. But by this time, a completely different class of drugs with a completely different chemical structure had emerged, the tricyclic antidepressants, which we use even today. Originally, they were envisioned as a possible new treatment for schizophrenia, but once their mood-lifting properties were discovered, they were repurposed as specific treatments for depression. The first one was marketed under the brand name Tofranil. Other companies began to hope that there might be more antidepressants waiting to be discovered. In 1959, one company researcher told the Wall Street Journal that that year would probably go down as the year of the antidepressant. But in the end, though, no radically new alternative drugs were created. Instead, other companies began challenging Tofranil's market share with a range of drugs that were really chemically similar, just a tweak here or there to differ. One of the new tricyclics, marketed under the brand name Elavil, did particularly well, not because it worked better than the other tricyclics, they all worked about the same, but because it was far more skillfully marketed. Now, there's no question that some patients given a tricyclic antidepressant experienced profound relief. In fact, one patient interviewed in 1977 by the New York Times felt he had experienced close to a miracle. He said, "It was as if I had been living in a perpetual fog, a drizzle, or wearing misted glasses for a long time, and something had suddenly wiped them clean. Everything shifted back into focus." But how did these drugs work? Did they affect the brain? Well, a great deal of research was done, and the answer seemed to be that they affected neurotransmitter levels in the nerve synapses in the brain. It's a little bit small, but basically what you see there are two flesh-colored objects, and in between you see a lot of little red dots. That is a synapse in the brain. You have a neuron here and a neuron there, and across this synapse, there's going to be conduction of an electric current. Basically, one of the nerve cells is going to tell the other nerve cell to conduct electricity, and they do it by means of neurotransmitters. I think most of you are familiar with this. The neurotransmitters, there are a variety, norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin. They are released by the synapse, rather by the neuron on the left. They pass across to the neuron on the right where they bind little receptors and the electric current goes forward. But when the current is, when there's no more need to send the signal, those little red dots, the neurotransmitters, are either broken down in the synapse by an enzyme called monoamine oxidase, or they're taken back up into the neuron on the left side by a reuptake process. So that's basically a synapse and how it works. And by the way, all of these neurotransmitters are called catecholamines. A researcher at Harvard took this information and produced a groundbreaking paper in 1965. In it, he proposed that some, if not all, depressions are associated with an absolute or relative deficiency of catecholamines, like serotonin, at receptor sites in the brain. On the other hand, elation may be associated with an excess of these catecholamines. This paper went on to become the most frequently cited paper ever published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and it set the agenda for biological research on depression for the next 25 years. Well, a few years later, the first discussion of depression as a chemical imbalance appeared in popular magazines. This was the origin of the theory of chemical imbalance. Publications from Cosmopolitan to the New York Times jumped on this idea. They explained that depression was caused by deficits in essential brain chemicals and that antidepressants could fix the problem. One 1977 newspaper headline written during the Thanksgiving holiday summed up this new thinking in this way: "No thanks on the holiday? Check your chemicals." Well, this new proposed connection between disordered mood and disordered biochemistry even made it into courtrooms. It was 45 years ago when San Francisco was shocked to learn of the murders of a public official named Harvey Milk and his colleague, Mayor George Moscone. Do these names sound familiar to some of you? Yeah. Milk's assassination was notable because he was the first openly gay person elected public office in the country. Both men had been murdered by a disgruntled former colleague of theirs named Dan White. And the story is this. White had resigned from the board on which all three men sat, partially because he clashed politically with Milk. He had then changed his mind because he had not been able to get a different career off the ground, and so he asked Moscone for his job on the board back. Originally, Moscone was going to reappoint him, but Milk encouraged Moscone to hold his ground, and so he changed his mind. In response to this, White armed himself with a gun and climbed through a window of the city office building to evade the metal detectors. He made his way to Moscone's office, argued with him over his reappointment, and then shot Moscone in cold blood. From there, White went directly to Milk's office and shot him 5 times as well, including twice in the head, execution style. Well, at White's trial, his lawyer suggested that he had not been wholly responsible for his actions because he was suffering from untreated depression. While he had previously been obsessed with fitness, they reported that he had recently indulged in a diet of junk food, including Twinkies. That's right. A psychiatrist was among several medical experts who testified of White's depression. He suggested that the extreme levels of sugar that White had consumed in recent weeks might have aggravated a chemical imbalance in the brain. This became known as the Twinkie defense, and it was all about the theory of chemical imbalance. And combined with other evidence, it was effective. White was convicted of manslaughter instead of murder. And he received a 7-year prison sentence, of which he served only 2. But unfortunately, less than 2 years after his release, he tragically committed suicide. As depression was being redefined as a chemical imbalance, it was also becoming known as a common disorder, as common people said as the common cold. The major reason was that anxiety was running into trouble. By the 1970s, the minor tranquilizers like Valium that were routinely prescribed for anxious patients were increasingly recognized as highly addictive. Some of you might remember that the former First Lady, Betty Ford, publicly admitted that she had both an alcohol and a Valium addiction. She was an alcoholic, Valium addict, and she checked herself into rehab. Valium had become a scary drug. Anxious people would have to find a new solution for their stress. But what if it turned out that many of those former consumers of Valium had not really been anxious after all, but rather depressed without being recognized as such? Well, in the meantime, those who supported a psychogenic cause of mental illness were shifting their focus from psychoanalysis to cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. In 1977, a 12-week study compared the effects of CBT and antidepressants in those patients with severe depression. The outcome was a stunner. CBT outperformed Tofranil, the standard medication for depression. Well, if depression could so effectively be treated simply by CBT, in which you attempt to change a person's negative beliefs about themselves, did it still make sense to think of it as resulting from chemical imbalance? But the theory of chemical imbalance made a strong comeback. Newer antidepressants arrived, the most popular being Prozac and Zoloft, still used today. And both of these had fewer side effects than tricyclics and MAO inhibitors. Prozac received FDA approval in 1987 and Zoloft in 1992. So instead of 12 weeks of CBT, you just took a pill once a day. The idea appealed to doctors and the general public, and so the popularity of Prozac took off. Now, Prozac and Zoloft were termed selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. Now, I spoke earlier of tricyclics. I mentioned that they work by blocking the reuptake of serotonin. I may not mention that, but that's how they work. They block the reuptake, they thought. Well, they actually do this. They may not help depression, but they actually do block the uptake of serotonin into the synapse. Okay? But they do it for not only serotonin, but also for norepinephrine, also dopamine. They were not selective. Okay? Plus, they had many other side effects. On the other hand, SSRIs were selective in that they only block the reuptake of serotonin. So we see the little serotonin, little green dots in between those two tan-colored things, and you see those blue things over here, those are the receptors. So serotonin comes out of that nerve cell up there. It goes across to these receptors. And there's a purple reuptake channel that the serotonin is taken back up into. Okay. Then in the photograph on the right, it's showing this little green thing, a little bit larger in that channel, in that purple channel, that's blocking the reuptake. So that is what a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor does. It blocks the reuptake of serotonin. And this introduced the idea that these were safer drugs, that because they were selective, they targeted only the parts of the brain responsible for depression. I don't know what part that is, but that is what they said. All other areas of the brain were supposedly spared. These drugs were also marketed in a direct-to-consumer ad campaign that promoted the idea that depression was caused by a deficiency of certain biochemicals in the brain, a chemical imbalance. Take an antidepressant, and that balance would be restored and your depression cured. As a result, prescriptions for antidepressants became commonplace, as they are today, 1 in 6. It wasn't until 23 years later, in 2010, that public skepticism toward chemical imbalance theories of depression finally began to catch up with growing skepticism among scientists. You had the general public as well as scientists being skeptical of this idea. And when this did happen, it wasn't so much because the public had reviewed the relevant scientific literature, but because public and media enthusiasm for SSRIs as a quick fix for a person's biochemistry had begun to dim. The drugs remained widely used, but with greater awareness that they did not always work, that they did not work forever, and that taking them was not without risk. Things continued to unravel. The drug industry was increasingly struggling with the placebo effect problem. Now, as you may know, in drug trials, the benefit of a particular drug being studied is always compared to the benefit that you get from a sugar pill, known as a placebo, that's given to some of the patients in the study. You compare the benefits of those patients given the placebo versus those given the drug to see if the drug is effective. Researchers began to look back at these drug studies, and they realized that the benefit from the placebo was almost as much as the benefit from the drug. The drugs weren't working much better than the placebo. And there was another problem for drug companies. New studies showed that for mild to moderate depression, antidepressants were no more effective than exercise, meditation, or CBT. That's what that earlier study had shown. So drug companies began to give up. For decades, they had struggled to create new drugs, and when they ran out of ideas, they then marketed the antidepressants they had for other conditions, such as chronic pain, anxiety, and insomnia. But now they had run out of brainy ideas, and they're beginning to think about cutting their losses. One after another drug company abandoned the field of psychiatry altogether, and now turn their attention to other things like developing new cancer treatments and, more recently, COVID vaccines. People even received Nobel Prizes for that. So where are we now in the year 2023? Let's talk about the theory of chemical imbalance. Theory can be summarized as follows. Mental illness is a result of a chemical imbalance in the neurotransmitter levels in the synapses in the brain. Now, this past year, a landmark paper was published out of the Department of Psychiatry at University College London. It looked at 17 leading studies. They call that an umbrella review. Studies from the psychiatric literature of the past 10 years that dealt with serotonin levels in patients with depression. Based on these papers, it then evaluated the evidence for whether depression is associated with lowered serotonin levels. And this is what they found. First, there was no difference in serotonin levels in people with and without depression. Furthermore, lowering serotonin levels did not produce depression in hundreds of healthy volunteers. The paper's conclusion was that the main areas of serotonin research provided no consistent evidence of there being an association between serotonin and depression, and no support for the hypothesis that depression is caused by lowered serotonin activity or concentrations. Basically, decreased serotonin levels are not associated with depression. There is no imbalance. In the opinion of many, this paper is the final nail in the coffin of the theory of chemical imbalance. Depression is not caused by an imbalance of chemicals in brain synapses. But even if depression is not caused by chemical imbalance, does altering the level of neurotransmitters improve the symptoms of depression? It may not cause it, but can it make it better? Well, when I spoke of the placebo effect, I made the point that most of the improvement in symptoms that you see with antidepressants appears due to the placebo effect. Basically, if a person thinks a medication is going to work, it will to some degree, whether that medication is a sugar pill or the actual antidepressant medication. And the paper arrives at the same conclusion, namely that antidepressants are only marginally effective in treating depression. What benefit they have is only slightly better than a placebo. But despite this overwhelming evidence, many physicians continue to prescribe SSRI antidepressants. The reality is that they really don't know how these medications work, and they'll tell you as such. The drugs do raise serotonin levels. Yes, they do work in the synapse. All these medications, the tricyclics, the SSRIs, they do elevate your neurotransmitters in the synapses. But we know that this change does not relieve depression. Elevate the level of serotonin, that doesn't relieve depression. On the downside, antidepressants have many side effects, and discontinuing them can be quite difficult. So of what benefit are antidepressants? Well, that's why you came here. This is the part you've all been waiting for. Medical doctors continue to use them, but often in combination with talk therapy. They believe this combination yields some degree of improvement, more in some people than others. But are the drugs really helping? Maybe it's the talk therapy that gives the benefit. And if you ask by what mechanism the antidepressants are working, the doctors can't give you an answer. To quote one, writing a prescription for an antidepressant remains as much of an art as a science. So are antidepressants useful for anything? Well, for postpartum depression, there's a new class of medications called neuroactive steroids, NAS. It shows a slight degree of improvement in postpartum depression. These drugs work on what are called GABA receptors, not the serotonin receptors in the brain. GABA is a neurotransmitter in the brain, like serotonin, but it does not promote transmission of impulses between nerve cells like serotonin does, but rather blocks their transmission. One NAS named zuranolone has recently been approved by the FDA for the treatment of postpartum depression. It shows some slight improvement in depression compared to placebo and with fairly minimal side effects. But think about it. This is the same old story that we've seen with SSRIs, minimal benefit. I spoke earlier of how drug companies will repurpose a drug into which they had poured millions of dollars for development, but that's not working for the use in which it was intended. They'll repurpose it for chronic pain and anxiety, and that's true of antidepressants. Chronic pain and anxiety. And why pain and anxiety? Well, narcotics are used for chronic pain, and Valium-type drugs are used for anxiety. They're both quite addictive, plus they have significant side effects. Antidepressants have been tried for both conditions, and although low doses don't have as many side effects as narcotics and Valium, again, they are not particularly effective. The one use for which low-dose antidepressants seem to be moderately effective is the treatment of insomnia. Fairly minimal side effects and somewhat effective. Trazodone is widely prescribed for that purpose. So we started this talk with a look at the various theories of mental illness, spiritual, psychogenic, and biologic. We've seen that biologic explanations have come up short after 7,000 years of trying. Now, does this mean that there are no biologic causes for mental illness? Well, what about the example I gave of syphilis and the mental illness it produces? Syphilis is not the cause of a mental illness, but it's the cause of a brain disorder. That's what GPI is. It's a brain disorder. Consider autism. It was once considered a mental illness and was called schizophrenia of the childhood type, but now it's considered to be a brain disorder. Brain disorders have a biologic cause, and as such, they have the potential to be successfully understood and treated by medical means. Now, does this mean that altering brain chemistry cannot improve the symptoms of mental illness? No. Our minds control our brains, and brains have electrical circuitry that can be altered by drugs, and this may give improvement in symptoms. This is not, however, a cure for the underlying problem. Just like giving a person a pain shot for abdominal pain does not cure a ruptured appendix. So what about depression? It is thus far stubbornly resisted biologic treatments to cure or even improve the symptoms. Doctors have no idea as to what the cause is. But why haven't we come up with something that at least improves the symptoms of depression, that treats the electrical circuitry of the brain so that the circuits carrying depressive thoughts are short-circuited, so to speak? Well, the reality is that scientists have just begun to understand the workings of the brain. How naive it is to believe that an antidepressant like Prozac that increases serotonin levels in all synapses in the brain is going to target the specific areas or brain circuits related to depression, if such areas even exist. Research into this goes on, but unless something is clearly biological, we would do well as counselors to depend on the all-sufficient and sure word of God for both diagnosis and treatment. And just closing thought, as Dr. Peter Bregan, who is a well-known psychiatrist, said, there is no good evidence for a chemical imbalance in the brain other than the imbalance caused by antidepressant drugs.
So the word of God is your answer to help in these depressed days.
Well, there are a number of things that can be that are a benefit.
Yes.
CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. If you are not a believer, if you're not involved in biblical counseling, CBT is effective. Okay, to some degree. It does as well or better than the antidepressants. But it's not a cure for it. It does improve the symptoms of some people. And that's the problem with a lot of these treatments. You don't know if there might be a certain subset of people who might benefit from them. But as it is, for all comers, antidepressants are just not effective. And they have significant side effects. But I hope you've gotten a sense from this of the story behind it. It really is a very involved and a very interesting story. But in the end, we come up with the reality that neither psychogenic nor biologic causes for mental illness are known. We don't know what causes mental illness from that perspective. I think we'd do much better to take our counselees to the Word of God. Word of God is living and powerful, or living and active. It certainly is a great aid in the treatment as well as in the understanding of the actual cause of many problems. We know that disease is a result of sin. All disease is a result of sin. Yeah. It may not be specific sin in a counselee's life, but it may be. Other thing I would bring up is that many things that seem to be mental illness types of things, like say depression, have those patients seen by a medical doctor, because conditions such as a low thyroid condition can present as depression. So this is a brain disorder, not a mental disorder. I think Jay had a question about go ahead, Ian.
Sure. Well, and it kind of stems even with what you said there about thyroid. Would we say then as biblical counselors that if there are what you might call proven physiological issues or problems, use the thyroid as an example, that mm-hmm. it is then appropriate that a medical doctor would prescribe something to help deal with the thyroid, that
Absolutely.
You do see changes in mood or behavior?
We know that the body and the spirit interact. Mind-body interaction. We are both. And that, so things that happen in our bodies, say we come down with a serious illness, come down with cancer, many individuals become depressed, okay? And on the other hand, we know that things that go on in our minds, like frightening thoughts, can cause reactions in our bodies. We may develop tachycardia, rapid pulse, diarrhea, things of that type. So there's definitely a mind-body interaction. So anytime any one comes in with a significant counseling issue, I think it's always a good idea to ask them about the last time they saw a medical doctor for just a general checkup, just to make sure that we're not dealing with something that can be helped medically because it's really more of a brain issue. Furthermore, I think anyone with any medical illness benefits from biblical counseling. A significant illness, we need to know how to handle that. John Piper said, don't waste your cancer, okay? And he was referring to the fact that he had prostate cancer, but yet that was something that he received counsel from the Word of God concerning, and that benefited his soul. God sends us these trials to perfect us. So again, take advantage of the Word of God, which is certainly living and powerful and able to do that. Yes, sir.
What was the context of that quote?
Peter Bregan is a psychiatrist who really had a long career where he was vehemently opposed to the use of psychiatric medication. He said he had never started a patient on a psychotropic medication. He spoke widely, and I believe that comes from one of his books.
He's a psychiatrist?
Yes, yeah. Peter Bregan in New York. Yeah. Very, very interesting guy. Yes, ma'am.
I don't know if you talked about this. I missed the first 10 minutes. But what about, like, mood stabilizers, you know, bipolar, which is kind of like, I work in a psychiatric hospital,
okay,
and that's so many more people are diagnosed with that.
Yes.
Because they have a manic episode. It's their behavior. It's
yes.
not their feeling.
Yes.
Depressed. It's, they did these things that were reckless or whatever, you know. You know, they're on a mood stabilizer, not really an antidepressant. Something like lithium or Depakote or Seroquel or something like that.
Right. Again, that's a very good question because, for instance, schizophrenia was thought to be a mental illness, but there is good evidence to suggest that it has deep roots in the brain. So for some of these things such as bipolar. And again, we talk about schizophrenia as if it's one illness. It's not. You have so many different types of things going on. Bipolar is the same way. And when you look at something like the DSM, which is nothing more than a collection of symptoms, and they apply names to these symptoms, this may have absolutely nothing to do with what the patients are really suffering from. It has nothing to do with classifying mental illness according to its cause. So you, and yes, there's some people with bipolar that I'm firmly convinced it is a brain disorder. And some of these agents that do affect the neurotransmitters or neuropathways in the brain are helpful in their treatment. But again, these people would also benefit from biblical counseling because these people have spiritual issues as well. So I think there's a place for both things, and certainly as both the medical and the biblical counseling side of things to come together. And as biblical counselors, we don't want to get involved with the medical. One thing I would say, though, is that if you have a patient who is under the care of a physician, as many of them are, they come in, they say, doctor, I'm feeling depressed, we'll take this. Take some Prozac, here's a prescription for it. And you see these people, can you counsel them? Of course, go ahead and counsel them. You're not going to have a problem with that. And give the doctor a call. Doctors are, you know, sometimes a little tough to get through to them, or sometimes you just speak to their nurse. The nurses are a great resource. But give them a call and just discuss things with them. Very, very open. They are, just as a physician, I'm always glad to hear from people, to talk to people about things, particularly if it's going to make my care of the patient better. Yes, sir.
Do you have any idea how much the medical field, the doctors have changed their view since that umbrella study has been put out?
I don't know that. I think there has been a general understanding over the last 10 years, and it's becoming more and more so that we don't know how antidepressants work. But on the other hand, if you talk to like your high psychiatrists who have very successful practices, they'll prescribe medication, they'll also do some talk therapy with patients, they'll do any number of things, and they'll concede, hey, we really don't know exactly how this is working, but it seems when you put it together with everything else, it seems to give some improvement to the patients. The patients are happier, they feel they're doing better, and so we don't know how it works, but we're going to use it. Well, you know, you've got the side effects. Well, that's the job of the psychiatrist, to manage the side effects. You know, you start taking off one antidepressant, putting on another, things of that type. I don't know that this one paper was eye-opening, because I think this has been a general understanding going on for the past 10 years, that the theory of chemical imbalance is not really the way it is. In fact, if you speak to people who are in the field of research, none of them ever believed it. I mean, it was something that was really applied by the popular press, Vogue magazine, New Yorker. I mean, it has a ring to it, and the drug companies picked right up on it, because this allowed them to sell their drugs to doctors, not psychiatrists as much as general practitioners, as well as to patients. So they had to direct to consumer marketing. You get things in the mail encouraging you, if you're feeling depressed, to ask your doctor for a prescription for Prozac. Hmm. Yes, sir.
Well, on the note that you just said,
yeah,
it seems like a lot of what you're saying, the undercurrent of a lot of this, is that it is driven by money.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so I mean, that's obviously a huge ocean of trouble.
Yeah. And a large part of the problem as well is that a number of the psychiatrists or just general practitioners are paid to participate in drug studies. And they're paid handsomely for that. So you find a very uneasy relationship there. Strange bedfellows. So that's why a lot of these laws have been coming out recently, sunshine laws, where you have to declare as a physician who you've been getting money from. And people can check that online, because it's a very unhealthy type of relationship. But yeah, there's no question.
It's still ongoing, right? It's still happening.
Well, I'm sure things happen, but it's becoming, you can see it happening, you can look it up, and because of that, people are less inclined to do it. You don't want to, as a doctor, be found to, you know, receive $100,000 from a drug company in a year. Your patients probably wouldn't appreciate that.
So for future reference, you would say that if you're counseling someone,
yes,
who has been on psychotropic drugs for, say, 20 years,
yes,
you don't tell them to stop.
But right.
You're saying counseling along with that is beneficial, or?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. And people adjust to those medications. And if you take them off the medications, they will do less well. Their bodies have adjusted to them. There was an imbalance caused by the antidepressant drugs, but the body has probably adjusted to that. And if you take them off, then the body has to readjust, and they may not do so well for a time. So I leave that to that's why psychiatrists are there. And they will definitely help for that. Psychiatrists, I know we all understand this, these are not evil people. These are people, and even more so than anyone else is, they have a genuine desire to help people. They are coming at it from a different worldview. And that's okay. But we can work with them to help our clients, help our counselees.
Yeah. I have a lawyer who would lash out sometimes, even in his own home or on the job,
yeah,
and he would have his bosses looking at him like, we should fire this guy. And then his wife would be like fearful of him because he punched a hole in the wall.
Yeah.
So I guess with the counseling, we're trying to teach him sanctification, even in the midst of
self-control.
Yeah, ups and downs.
Yeah, I don't think anger is a psychiatric illness.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yes. Can I say one thing? Since I'm your wife, I am a life soul. I'm not just black.
She's advertising.
No, I want to say, in general, it just occurred to me in all of this that it could be that none of these people are born again, that they may not even have a relationship with their creator or their savior. So as biblical counselors, couldn't we lovingly speak through the gospel to them in their whatever state they're in mentally, and help them get connected to Christ the Savior? Because I lay big money down right now. You know people, and I know people. We assume they probably know this or that, but they don't. Even religious people in your churches and mine, there are many, many, many people that do not really have never really repented and become born again as a child of God. I just offer that freely because I think it's essential. And if you would please consider that, I think it'd go a long way to helping troubled people in every way.
Well, I think that's just a standard part of, as you, a very, very excellent point. Any counseling situation, first session, you got to talk to them about where they are with the Lord. Because if we do not have the Holy Spirit on our side, then what we have to offer is we have nothing to offer.
Right, but I'm just pulling that thread because.
And that's something that Stuart Scott has just pounded home. Yeah, thank you.
Just a reminder.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to get your opinion. I've been in audiences before where Daniel Berger told the groups on bipolar that the manic phase was essentially a person with exuberant, out of control pride, and that the depressive phase was essentially a person with wild, out of control, wounded pride. Have you heard that, and do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, for some cases of bipolar, that's probably the case, but I don't think that's true of every case of bipolar, and that's part of the problem that we're talking about. I think certain cases of bipolar are truly brain disorders. On the other hand, you can have someone like King David. You know, he was acting like a madman, just drooling on himself and pulling out his hair. And this, you say, well, the guy was schizophrenic. No, he wasn't schizophrenic, but yet he looked schizophrenic. But someone said, oh, he was schizophrenic. So there's a wide variety of, just within the bipolar, a wide variety of illnesses, I think, that are present within that. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate that.
You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.